Welcome to CFRI Cystic Fibrosis Community Voices, a video podcast series created by and for the cystic fibrosis community.
I'm interested in how all the technical information that we learn at this conference, how does that get boiled down and entered into actual treatment in various hospitals? How do we go from the theoretical to the practical and the testing? And any one of you can answer that question from your perspectives.
You know, I think it takes time, a lot of people working together. You know, whether you want to start with basic scientists who make some interesting novel observations, and those are picked up by translational scientists and who think about how to translate the finding from the laboratory into a clinical realm, how to test that particular idea from a clinical perspective, and then finally, doing the clinical studies themselves in patients and seeing whether something that was an idea of a 20 years ago actually leads to a treatment that leads to benefit. And then once you do the studies like that, then it's up to the clinicians to look at the studies and say, okay, does this apply to my particular patient? So I think it's time, it's a team approach and people working together.
Yeah, I would just add that there's a role for guidelines. And this is something that the CF Foundation has driven a lot, bringing groups of experts together to review these studies that come out, and at a certain point of time, sort of give a level of strength of recommendation based on how good the studies are, and then put out the guidelines that are published. And in CF, the guidelines, there's a bit of teeth attached to them because the foundation grants are, to some degree, based on how closely a given center is adhering to current guidelines, which is not the case in many fields of medicine. And so that's really led to an improvement. And part of the improvement in outcome has been this process of translating from the studies to the guidelines to the centers.
I would absolutely echo what Dr. Moss said about guidelines. We look to the guidelines a lot. Clinicians like me who don't do any bench or clinical research, we look at guidelines for innovations and changes, and also we look for into the literature to see what kinds of things have come through, and we try to apply what we read to our daily practice. And the other thing that happens is that patients get involved in clinical trials. Sometimes we send patients, my center doesn't do clinical trials, we send them across town to Dr. Jane's center to get involved in clinical trials.
I also think too, for you being parents or caregivers or family members here, that it's also important to understand that as medical providers, that there's so much research out there, and sometimes, as you know, there's different sessions to this conference that they might not be aware of what you learned at this conference. So take the information you learned as a parent or a caregiver back to your center and say, I learned this really great information at this conference. I think you should look into it, and making them aware of that, because sometimes, with all best intentions, they want to be aware of all these new trends that are out there, but every day with the new advances, it can be hard and a challenge to keep up with them. So take that back to your medical team and your providers too, to advocate for yourself and say, I learned this really great information at this conference, and bring it to your team's attention, and then work with them on that.
Thank you.
I just had one more comment.
Certainly.
These guidelines are available on the CFF.org website, but one of the initiatives that is likely going to come in the next year or so is that these guidelines are sometimes technical, but there's going to be an effort to translate them into language that a lay audience could understand. And so I'm sure you'll get some communication from the foundation once that's available, but just keep an eye out for that.
Great. Well, thank you. Let's open it up for the first questions. Just state your name and go ahead.
Okay. My name is Jennifer Cornell. I have a question that's related to Dr. Moss's discussion about Aspergillus. So for a patient that has chronic Aspergillus issues that have caused hospitalizations and exacerbations, as far as we can tell, what and who does not have ABPA, You mentioned, you know, IgE and steroids, that would be more ABPA reaction. This, can you expand a little bit about the inhaled antifungal and some of the reactions that patients are seeing with that?
Well, most commonly that problem would be treated with an oral azole agent, like itraconazole. But if there are problems with that, an alternative would be to inhale amphotericin. And fortunately, there are some efforts now in industry to develop other antifungal inhaled agents, which are not yet approved. They're investigational. But over the next few years, hopefully, we'll begin to see those available. And they'll be easier to use than amphotericin, which people now are using the IV solution, putting them in nebulizers and giving a nebulization treatment. And there are various schedules for that, but it takes time, and some people can't tolerate it. So that's really a niche now that is relatively small, but hopefully will improve in the future. For the most part, in situations where aspergillus seems to be causing an infection problem, it's going to be an oral azole agent. And again, in that situation, monitoring of drug levels and testing for resistance of the isolate are important components of that care.
Go ahead.
Dr. Moss, Elaine Peterson. Dr. Moss, on your detection of the fungus, in cancer we have the PET scan. Is there anything like that for the fungus? And the reason I'm asking is that very dear friend had a lung transplant, and he was on all these medications, and they didn't know that he had a brain fungus, and that's what took him.
Well, people, the transplant teams are, as I understand it, I'm not a transplant physician, but as I understand it, they do look for this problem pretty aggressively. And it's known that if you have aspergillus at the time of your transplant, there's a high chance you will get invasive aspergillosis post-transplant. So these people are treated pretty intensively, usually with voriconazole, and that usually works well. I don't know of any other monitoring tests besides the cultures that are done, usually by during the regular bronchoscopies that transplant patients get. They certainly are looking for fungal infection as part of that evaluation. But I'm not aware of other imaging tests, for example, like you mentioned PET scans, that would apply to this.
I think that when you have a lung transplant, there's competing stresses on your system. You want to try to prevent rejection because, you know, the thing that causes most failure of lung transplant is chronic rejection. So you have to use very strong medication to prevent that from happening, because if you get rejection, the lung's going to fail. But on the flip side is when you use these medications to prevent rejection, you suppress your own immune system. It's relatively unusual for a fungal infection to go to other parts of the body like the brain, and that's obviously very unfortunate. But the way to normally screen for fungal infections is to look for the infection in the lungs. And generally, they don't look for other parts of the body unless there's specific symptoms that are occurring with a given patient.
Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Alicia, and my question is regarding bacteria Burkholderia sepatia. If it's believed that it's been cultured, what advice would you give the patient or the parents to confirm that, in fact, there is that presence in the lungs, and where to begin to try to understand more about it?
So Burkholderia sepatia has obviously a very checkered history. About 15 or 20 years ago, there were reports of sepatia syndrome, where there was a rapid deterioration for some patients after they were cultured with sepatia. As time's gone on, what we've realized is that sepatia is just not one bacteria. There are different subspecies, sometimes referred to as genomivars. And some genomivars are not as bad as others. Now, most CS centers, when they culture Sapacia, send their culture to a reference laboratory at the University of Michigan, run by a very well-known and experienced microbiologist, John LaPuma. And they will confirm the presence of Sapacia and then also give you information about what subspecies, genomovar, it is. And if you have a question about it, you can just ask your CF physician, say, you know, if you culture Sapacia, has this been confirmed by the reference laboratory?
Sure. Great, and I see we're joined now by Dr. Reed DeMarco. Good morning. The very first question we asked was had to do with, and I just give you the opportunity to respond because everyone else did as well, talk a little bit about the areas of research and how we take some of the things that we learn about here today, how do we get them into actual usage in the hospitals and in the CF treatment centers? And the other four guests have already responded to that question.
Yeah, so the main question is, so how do we take sort of bench research and get it to a clinic? Mm-hmm. So some of that is largely out of our control, especially in my side. So on the research side, a lot of it comes down to investors and things that I'm not really totally familiar with. But from a patient standpoint and being someone with CF, look into clinical trials that aren't really the major ones that we hear about. So look into some of the anti-infective ones. If you go onto the CFF pipeline, you'll see that there are a number of things that are not really getting a lot of the spotlight. So make sure you put attention to things that really aren't on the modulator front. So it'll kind of give a little bit of motivation for those of us in the laboratory to research things that aren't on the CFTR side. And that'll be pretty helpful.
Great, thank you. Go ahead, next question.
Hi there. Dr. Jane, this is directed towards your talk about the CF pipeline, but everybody's welcome to answer. I'm just wondering your thoughts on or hopes for RNAi or RNA interference therapies that are in development right now for CF. There are a couple of other companies that are almost ready to launch medications in ATTR amyloidosis as well as hemophilia, and there's another company working on a molecule for CF that's an RNAi interference drug. I just wanted to know your thoughts on that.
I am not as familiar with RNA interference. There are approaches of RNA where you do RNA replacement or RNA editing. There was a trial that was completed about a year and a half ago, which looked at RNA editing, where you actually deliver through nebulization a series of molecules that can actually take an abnormal RNA and correct it, edit it into a normal RNA, which would make the normal protein. That showed some effect, but as far as I know, that trial has not led to a phase three at this point. We are about to start a trial of using nanoparticles, I think I referred to it yesterday, which would allow normal RNA, normal CFTR RNA, to be nebulized and using this nanoparticles to be delivered to the airways. The idea being the nanoparticle would help to deliver the RNA into the cell where it needs to be to correct the underlying defect. Now, RNA interference, I'm not as familiar with, to be honest with you.
Great. Do we have another question?
Hi, my name is Stacy Ravelis, and my husband and I think the world of this conference, and this is amazing to have a panel to ask questions of. We were very excited when our daughter became eligible for ivacaftor, but also nervous because it didn't seem like we could get an answer as to what is it. And I guess as a parent, I consider nutrition and medication and everything a way to communicate with cells. So From that page, can you help us understand what is ivacaftor? As far as I can tell, it's not a peptide. We're wondering, you know, are we putting little Lego pieces to bind to the missing Lego pieces? It's a chemical, as far as I can understand, it's a chemical. What is it? Is it brand new? Does it replicate something else that we can understand? What are we asking her body to do? And then maybe that would help us feel better about some of the side effects that we're watching for.
Well, to understand, I mean, in some ways, we have the treatment before we understand how actually it worked. I mean, if you go back and look at how these molecules were discovered, they were discovered based on their ability to rescue CFTR in an assay that, you know, could be done on the thousands and millions of different molecules. And basically, it was just like, let's see what actually works. It's technically defined as a small molecule, so it's not a peptide. The exact structure of which is actually I'm not familiar with, but it's a small organic molecule. The way it works is that it binds to the actual mutant CFTR protein. So it binds it and it changes the configuration of the protein in a way that it opens the protein more effectively. It's thought not to be normally in the body, if that is a question. So it is something artificial in that sense. What I can tell you in terms of the, you know, one of the things you always worry about over when you have a new treatment is what are the long-term effects. And now it's been out since 2012 or so. We're getting 6-7 years into its lifetime. And at this point, no unexpected toxicities have cropped up. You know, sometimes FDA approves a drug and then retroactively says, okay, it's not safe in this kind of situations. None of that has happened with ivacaftor at this point. So obviously we have to be vigilant and keep an eye out for things as more time accumulates. But as I demonstrated in my my talk yesterday, it's starting to accumulate that you're having not just short-term benefit, but longer-term benefits as well. So I don't know if that completely answers your question, but that's what we understand.
Yeah, I would just add to what Manun just said, if you remember, particularly Dr. Verkman's talk yesterday, he talked about optimization. So these screening tests pick up molecules when you add them in acutely into this test system, so it opens up the chloride channel. That's not a drug. You have to go from there to something that's safe, that lasts in the body long enough to have a significant effect that might be available through the oral route. And that process of optimization can take a long time, and it's basically in the hands of physical chemists, organic chemists, at whatever company or entity is working on the initial hit drug. So it's an important intermediary step between the discovery of a type or class of molecules that might have an effect and an actual drug. Now, ivacaftor is the end result of that process that occurred between roughly 2000 and 2005 at Vertex in San Diego, at their San Diego Research Center. So it can take a long time to get that done. So initially, you make that discovery, and then you turn it over to your chemists to create a drug out of that. And they know how to do that. There are things you put on the molecule to let it last longer in the body, things that you put on the molecule that allow it to get absorbed through the GI tract. So those are all part of the process.
And just to add a little bit to that as well, before any human being takes the medication, anything new goes through extensive animal testing at doses much higher than a patient would ever see. And in this animal testing, every organ is examined to see whether there's any damage or anything that we need to look out for. And so there is a lot of testing that occurs to look for safety before any human being ever actually sees a novel or new compound. Now, that doesn't exclude the possibility that we'll see something down the road, because these studies don't go for years and years. But there is a lot of work that goes into it before any human being would ever take something new, like ivacaftor.
And do we have anybody that wants to ask questions for some of the other panelists as well? Look through the speaker's profile and remember what you heard at their talks, and think about any questions you might ask the rest of the panel as well. Go ahead, next.
Actually, this possibly could be answered by Reed. I'm not sure exactly what stuff you all worked on, but is the increased inflammation in the CF lung a problem for vector type delivery systems, like either virus or the nano stuff? I mean, does that increase in inflammation keep those from working well?
So I wasn't really involved with this, more the drug delivery side within the lung. But just by some of the lectures I've been to and some of the talks I've been to, I think that there is a bit of concern just in terms of a lot of the work that has been done to understand delivery into the lung is usually done in an animal model or in healthy patients who don't have CF. But obviously when you have CF, you have very different profiles just because of thick sputum. And also, you can also have bronchiectasis. So studying delivery within the CF lung is incredibly difficult. So I'm not terribly familiar with what the inflammatory profiles might look like, but I think we can all guess that it's going to be a bit more complicated when studying this in the lung of someone with CF.
I have a question from someone online, but because it's directed to Dr. Moss, I'll ask my question first, which is to the panel, because I'm following instructions, Daryl. And my question is related to transplant, and I'm sorry the physicians aren't here today, but this panel, I'm sure many members could address it. With the whole revised scoring system, which has been advantageous for people with CF versus working chronologically, it seems like there are quantitative measures that are clear. You know, what's your FEV1, what's your BMI, all those things. The part that I think is difficult for many people is the qualitative part, and that quite often is the mental health, psychosocial support aspect. And I've heard from many adults who are on the verge of being listed or listed, who feel, you know, it's like the classic Seinfeld episode with Elaine's black mark in the book, you know, that she can't get a doctor because everybody, it's been marked in the book and everybody knows her. This fear of how to behave, or, you know, fear of canceling an appointment, or whether, you know, cross-infection guidelines, et cetera. And I'm just wondering if you can address what your thoughts are on how to finesse that to best represent the needs of the CF community. I know it's a tough one.
I would start by sharing that I think you need to be yourself and you need to be honest, because if you're dishonest with yourself or with your transplant center or your CF care team center, that won't help you at all. I think trying to get engaged with the transplant center earlier rather than later to work through these issues before listing is ideal, and having more time to work through these issues before listing and before transplant can only be helpful. So that would be my advice, to get evaluated for transplant early rather than late.
So is your question more about how not to jeopardize your evaluation by a transplant team by giving the wrong signals? Is that kind of the genesis of that?
You know, it's clear what their FEV1 is, et cetera, but the other part, and I just had a conversation with someone who I really needed to be on this very important panel, and she had a transplant appointment, and she was very nervous about trying to reschedule, because is that an indication of her lack of commitment to the process? That's kind of it's a qualitative assessment there versus right. Something quantitative. So it's how do we perfect the system, especially as more adults with CF are seeking transplants?
Well, one of the things that happens, you know, we have a transplant program at Northwestern, and the physicians are different than the CF physicians, but we have a very good relationship with them. And they will ask us, like, you know, we know our patients for years and decades, and they meet them once or twice, but they will look to us to say, well, you know, is this person a good candidate or not a good candidate? And I think that communication is really important in terms of the qualitative aspects of candidacy, I guess. And so I think that if I think patterns are important. I mean, I think for an isolated, I have to miss an appointment because I have A, B, or C, that's one thing, that's life. I think generally, though, if you have a pattern of behavior which would reduce your, which would cause problems or cause people to be a little bit wary, then that I think is a bigger issue. I think for a one-off kind of thing, I think those tend to be sort of washed away more if your CF team feels like you're gonna be a good candidate. That communication to the transplant team is really important.
Can I just add one thing to that, which is, and this came up in your talk with opioid use, the variability from center to center is quite large. And I think that's something that is not just about opioids, but in many aspects of transplant care, including the selection process. They've tried to standardize, but there's still a lot of variability. And I think the foundation is trying to address this now. They're really focusing on transplant and have hired somebody who is a transplant physician and also have groups working on trying to get more uniformity and guidelines, if you will, in terms of approach, so that there's more certainty in the patient community about what's happening. What we see now are people, you know, shopping around transplants, get rejected at X, you go to Y, problems are Y, you go to Z, you get taken at Z. So that's not an ideal situation, but hopefully we'll get better standardization in the future. I don't know if you want to comment on that at all.
I would echo what both of these physicians have said about the communication between your CF care team and the lung transplant center. So our center does not have a transplant center, but we refer out to, there are about three or four other centers in our geographic area, and we communicate closely with them. Trust your CF care team, and I would agree with the patterns. If someone has shown us consistent patterns of making a good effort, of trying to be adherent, it's okay if you miss one appointment or have one issue here or there. It's life, as Dr. Jane said. But if you've had a consistent pattern over years and years of not making your appointments, of missing your therapies, it's important to make your CF center recognize that you have made a deep effort to change. And if you've proven that you're willing to change and willing to make the effort, that will show through. Your CF care center will let your transplant center know that.
I also think, too, coming from a pediatric care team who we don't have a transplant center, and so we also refer out, is that that CF care team, peds or adult, becomes part of your family, and they know the ins and outs, and sometimes you feel like I can't talk to them about certain things because they know me too well. And what we've seen with some of our patients who go for transplant is they're a little bit more open with the transplant team because they don't have that shared history, which is something we found a little bit more of that open communication. What we've also seen too, because we also don't have a transplant center, we do refer out, but some of our patients, they go for evaluations or they almost do like a meet and greet at different transplant centers to say, you know, maybe I want to go to the one that's an hour and a half away. But we've also had patients who have traveled. I'm on the East Coast in Pennsylvania, and we've had patients who say, you know what, we went all the way to North Carolina because we felt the best connection with their center, with that transplant team. And so really having that opportunity to say, as a patient and family members, to say, I want to go where I feel most connected to this new team, because it is scary, it's that fear of the unknown. And we know research shows us that people with CF have an increased levels of anxiety and depression, that research is out there. But also understanding that all transplant teams should have psychology or social workers on that team to also ease that transition from a mental health perspective too, because it's not just the physical ailments, there's also mental health that goes along with it. So really looking at the holistic perspective of that.
And I think one thing as well is that when you go to a CF clinic and you're not eligible for transplant or not even thinking about it, the word transplant doesn't even come up when you go to a clinic. Mm-hmm. And you don't think about it. So I guess I imagine, like, when you are suddenly talking about transplant, there's this massive learning curve. So for example, I wouldn't know what it was like to go through transplant. I don't even really know what medications you take specifically. I think that when you go to your first CF appointment, you have so much to learn. You're kind of mastering what it's like to have CF, and then you suddenly transition to mastering pre-transplant and then transplant. So maybe a bit more transparency in what the process looks like, talking about it before you even need it, would be helpful as well.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. And I'm really only hogging the mic because now I'm asking a question from Amy, who sent this in, who's watching online, and it's for Dr. Moss. The CFF guidelines exist for ABPA. Is anyone working on aspergillus or mold or fungi? Thank you. I always want to say fungi. Fungi guidelines. I run a Facebook group for CF people who culture aspergillus and or have a high IgE specific to aspergillus. We see people with aspergillus bronchitis who have doctors not willing to treat with antifungals, despite declining lung function with use of antibiotics. We have over 400 people on this group, CF people. We often hear CF doctors citing the 2003 CFF ABPA guidelines as the reason for not treating with antifungals, but patients are suffering because antibiotics are being used. Where antifungals are needed and frequently work. If new guidelines aren't the answer, what do you recommend for these patients with rapidly declining lung function who don't have ABPA but struggle?
Well, you're right. There are no guidelines for that particular piece of the puzzle. And we're sort of getting back to the initial question about this translation from research to patient care. We're still in that mid-zone of trying to get enough information to formulate guidelines that are evidence-based. So, and unfortunately, a lot of this work is, more of this is being done in a lot more in Europe than in North America at this point. So I think it's a wait and see game for the actual patient that's confronting that. The best thing is to be well educated and to have that dialogue with your provider. And if you're uncomfortable with what you're hearing, then ask for referral to some other person that has more experience or some center that has more experience. And that's, I get a lot of calls from different people around the country for precisely that reason, that they're kind of getting a sense of uncertainty from their provider or resistance, as you mentioned, in that particular case, to taking action. So you have to be your own advocate, and that's a lot of what CFRI is about, right? So this is just one area where your own arming with knowledge and advocacy is what's going to get you better care.
Go ahead.
Thank you. My question's along the lines of, are there any new options or new aggressive treatments to treat colonized Pseudomonas in a patient that has frequent lung infections that have used the current available medications out there, but hasn't received a great response from them?
Sorry, which infection?
Pseudomonas infection. It's personal. He's got Pseudomonas and Stenotrophomonas, and he's been in repeatedly for the last 2 years, every 6 to 8 weeks.
So and I assume you're talking about chronic treatment. We obviously have two approved antibiotics that are inhaled. There are other drugs in development that also target Pseudomonas. There's a formulation of fosfomycin and tobramycin that has been tested and is slated for further development, which would target both Pseudomonas and MRSA. There are plans to develop a nebulized gallium as well as intravenous gallium, which may have efficacy against Pseudomonas as well. So there are things that are being developed. It's not approved in this country, but in Europe you can use inhaled colistin or it's actually dry powder colistin, ciprofloxacin is something that's all. So there's lots of development going on, but right now we have those two options, but more to come possibly.
Go ahead.
Yes, good morning, gentlemen and ladies. My question is more on the psychosocial. Recognizing that all the guidelines are extremely important, we've lost the psychosocial benefits of contact with one another. My daughter is 32, so she was before all of these very strict guidelines. Those friends she made at camp are still her go-to in person when she can, because she needs they don't have to touch each other. They just need to be in the same room or at the same picnic table. Is there work being done to try and, I know you have virtual chat rooms and all that, but something where they can actually work on figuring out how to build on the psychosocial needs of young adults who are being so isolated?
So I think part of this, and this is what I spoke about yesterday, is that is the big challenge now. And with the guidelines continue to increase, so the old guidelines, you know, before there were guidelines, there were camps and all these groups, right? And then in 2003, the guidelines said, okay, all this research said now there was this droplet precaution in these cross infections, so it was 3 feet, right? And now all of a sudden with the 2013 guidelines, it's 6 feet, and that really is a barrier, right? They can't, you know, one person per room, and they are very detailed. If you read the fine print, they're very detailed with the restrictions. But that being said, it's up to personal interpretation, right? So as a medical provider, we're gonna educate you and say, this is what the guidelines say, this is the research behind it. And I know from a foundation perspective, and something that's coming up for NACFC, the North American Cystic Fibrosis Conference, is that there's a big push now, very recently, to look at what are those psychosocial implications, because it's very much based on all of these medical advances with the technologies, which are wonderful, but what does that impact have on psychosocial? What impact does that have on connection? So my hope is that in the very near future, we're gonna continue to be able to research that, and for the individuals with CF and these young adults and adults to give voice to their concerns and make it known that these are the challenges, because without hearing from them specifically and without being able to advocate, you know, and just coming from a medical team, it doesn't have as much effort or impact as it would coming from the individuals living with CF specifically. So go out there and advocate for yourself, make noise about it and say, you know, let's do more research and let's figure out a way for us to be able to get some face-to-face connection, because the technology only goes so far. But being able even to just be in the same room, it's a shared experience, right, that you miss behind technology. So I really think advocacy is the best thing right now, and my hope is that the research continues and that we can see some sort of change, because there is definitely a lack of that right now within the community.
Thank you.
I had the same question. I was going to word it differently. I was going to ask if you were going to go to the CFF and like slap some people. And, but I had another question for Dr. D'Amico. I'm curious what your next steps in life are going to be. Are you going to like rest for a little bit, or are you going to keep on taking the world? Or?
So I move out of Nashville August 24th, and I move to DC September 14th. So I have 3 weeks off where I'm probably going to go home and stay with my family. And then, so my fellowship at the FDA is only about a year long, and then after that, I have no idea what I'm doing. And we'll see what happens. I think a large part of my steps with CF have been like, okay, I'll graduate high school. Oh, I wasn't supposed to get here. Now what? College, now what? And I think for me, it's kind of like I just keep getting to these next steps, and I'm like, okay, well, I'll go from here. So yeah, I hope to take some time off just to repivot and just like lay low a little bit. I haven't really been home for more than 2 weeks in probably 8 years. So it'll be really nice.
Hi, this is a question for Dr. Chen. This is a very broad question about pain. When you have CF, there's a lot of things that can cause pain in CF. And as CF is a invisible disease, so is pain. You can't see it, but you can, people feel it, and it's difficult to treat. My question is, a lot of times for people with CF, the pain kind of sneaks up on them, and it's caused by things that aren't going to go away. It's not a muscle strain often. It's maybe pain from disease progression or antibiotics, perhaps, that they can't avoid. You mentioned yesterday that you have some strategies for dealing with pain without taking opioids. Can you kind of share with us a little bit about how you might look at the whole picture when the pain is starting and what people can do to kind of distract themselves and move around it?
Absolutely. Living with chronic pain is not easy, and unfortunately, masking chronic pain with drugs doesn't always help the most. And so it's a total holistic approach that needs to be taken with each individual. And so using our social workers and mental health specialists, therapists, and you know, I personally don't teach a lot of these techniques, but I know that cognitive behavioral therapy helps a lot. Coping strategies. Our social workers are a great resource for these kinds of things, as well as our psychologists. And then outside of the medical field, unfortunately, a lot of things that aren't covered by insurance, but exercise, yoga, meditation can all really help how the brain processes pain signals.
Go ahead.
Probably doctors, you may go into better for this. When is the easiest or best way to disclose your CF disease when applying for a school or an employment?
With universities, I've always been pretty open. I'm still trying to figure out employment. So when I was finishing up my PhD, I was looking at a number of job opportunities. Correlation doesn't equal causation, so I don't know what this means, but I actually had a few CVs and resumes where I took off all evidence that I had CF, and those were more successful at getting hired. I don't know what that means, but I'm still trying to figure it out, because a lot of people with CF, if someone just Googles what CF is, if they're not familiar with it, then yikes, they might not want to hire someone who could be sick so long. So I'm not sure yet. I don't know.
Hey, I agree. It's a very tricky, delicate balance, I would say, especially, I mean, college is a little bit easier. And the same thing, like Reed mentioned, applying to college, like you talked about how when you finally came to terms with it, you used it to try to get into school and sort of share that as your personal statement. And I think that that can benefit someone, right? Because it is who you are, and it's part of you, and it's part of your story. And I think college is a little bit different than workforce, because in college, cystic fibrosis is considered a disability, so you can go to your university disability services with your documentation and get extra time for assignments and, you know, get excused absences and things like that. Hopefully your faculty are a little bit nicer than Reed's faculty were at the universities that you attend, and they're a little bit more understanding when you get those services. But it's a very tricky balance, but I would agree with Reed about work because it is personal, and because even though there are all these beautiful anti-discrimination laws, does not mean if you have on your CV or your resume or your cover letter, oh, and by the way, I have cystic fibrosis, because some employers might not want to hire you, but it's because you don't have certain qualifications, even though maybe it's really because you have cystic fibrosis. So really thinking about that too, and then once you do get hired and you're there, that's what we have FMLA for, but understanding that Family Medical Leave Act for individuals with cystic fibrosis, you have to work for a company that has more than 50 employees, you have to be there for at least a year or a certain number of hours, and then at that point, then you have job security. So it can be very tricky. So it's definitely something to talk about with your care team and to work through a plan that works best for you. Because other times, if an individual is sicker with their cystic fibrosis and they're obtaining disability, they're getting SSD, there is an option for them to work a certain number of hours and then also get disability for a certain amount. So really, there's a lot of options, and it's a very intricate process. So hopefully I answered your question a little bit to it, but it is a balance and it is unique for each person.
Foundation has a legal hotline.
Yes, thank you. Very good point. So Beth Suffian is wonderful. The CF Legal Hotline, if you don't know about it, write it down. They will help your family members, your patients. Before somebody applies for disability, before you even start the process, call the CF Legal Hotline because they will help guide you through that process, because it's very challenging across the United States to get disability. So let them help you get all your medical records together. So call them first. So absolutely call Beth Suffian at the CF Legal Hotline. Thank you.
So for those of you watching on the internet, the question was about the CF Legal Hotline, which she answered. Thank you. Go ahead, next question.
Just to add on to that, as an adult with CF, I don't say anything about CF until I have the job, and then I'll, you know, maybe talk to HR if I need accommodations. And then my question for Dr. Chen, I don't think you addressed arthritis and CF-related arthritis. I was wondering if you could talk about that, because I had a friend who, she would get an infection and then all her joints would ache for like a month, and it sounded really awful, but I don't really know what triggers it, how, and if you know about it. So thank you.
I'll be honest, I don't know too much about infection-triggered related arthritis in CF, but it is very common to get CF-related osteoarthropathy, so joint and bone pain, and I can only imagine that inflammation and infection and exacerbation can worsen that. What I would say is that treatment for that, it's important to not be a martyr and to use medications to treat that appropriately and cautiously, because we have seen people become very dependent on opioid medications due to bone and joint pain. But on the other hand, opioid medications really can improve quality of life. So I would say start treating that with anti-inflammatories first, because it probably is an inflammatory condition. A month of chronic anti-inflammatories can be a little scary when you're taking antibiotics that can hurt your kidneys too, so just make sure you're getting your kidneys checked regularly. But anti-inflammatories, Tylenol and low-dose opioids can be very helpful, especially added all together. It's not risky to take medications together.
One thing that'll help me sometimes when I feel like an exacerbation's coming on and I'm coughing a lot, it'll just start stretching more and doing more yoga. I don't really know the correlation between joints and infection, maybe getting arthritis, but with me, if I'm coughing a lot, the muscles in my core will get strained a lot, and I feel like my back goes out kind of a thing, and like I don't know how that actually correlates to the rest of my body, but doing extra yoga and stretching helps me a good bit so I can prevent some of those aches that come with infection.
Hi everyone, my name is Rebecca Carazzi. I have a 27-year-old brother with CF. He doesn't have a modulator yet that would work for him, but you know, there's a lot in the pipeline. I think his biggest question is, once there is something, will that decrease my treatment burden? So I'm curious if we even know, I mean, folks haven't been taking these that long, so there's may not be enough time yet that has passed, but I am curious if there is potential for these drugs that are treating the underlying cause of the disease, whether the treatment burden that folks have with CF will change over time. And so I guess it's looking at the youngest folks now who are starting on these earlier.
Well, you bring up a question that I think every one of my patients asks, can I stop X, Y, or Z? So I think the short answer is I ask them not to stop anything. For a couple of reasons. I think what we've seen, and sort of the theme has been, while these drugs are an incredible advance, they are not cures. So they may have taken a severe form of CF and made it a more milder version, but especially if you're an adult, you have bronchiectasis, you have Pseudomonas infection, and you may reduce it a little bit, and that's, I'm not sure that's actually clear. So that's one part of it. The second part of it is these drugs, when they were tested in studies, were tested with patients taking their usual treatments. That was DNAs, hypertonic saline, bronchodilators. So what we really only know is that they work when you take these other medications. Now, they may work without them. We don't know that. Now, there is an impetus within the TDN and the CF Foundation to look at this question, like, can we pull things off? And there are studies being planned, just in the planning stage at this point, to see whether we can take these something off safely without causing any rebound effects or any sort of attenuation of the efficacy. Now, the real power, I think, of these modulators is to start them very early, before you actually have structural lung problems, maybe rescue the pancreas, prevent diabetes, potentially. But we're not going to know that for a long time. As I showed yesterday, the trials are just being done in patients who are 2 to 5, just being reporting out under the age of 2 years. But that's where I think the real potential of these modulators is that we can delay structural lung disease, delay Pseudomonas infection. And if that occurs, then obviously the treatment burden is going to be diminished because the treatments that we do now are to address those kind of complications that we happen with CF.
So for the younger kids, are you still treating them with everything
and putting them
on modulators, or is there a
need
to start to treat symptoms as they come up?
I'm going to defer that to my pediatric
colleague. Yeah. And can you repeat the question for the folks that were on the internet?
The question is, are we still adding this drugs the same way now that the modulators are here? And so far the answer is yes. There are guidelines for initiation of therapy in infants that focus on nutrition and airway clearance, and then the addition of chronic pulmonary meds comes later. That's not been so well worked out as to what gets added when, but there's a general pattern to that. And I think the hope is that as the modulator study, now ivacaftor is being looked at in 6 to 12 month old now, and the approval of the 1 to 2 year old is probably coming fairly soon. So we're going to have a cohort of very young children that are started on ivacaftor for particular mutations who may not need to get drugs added because their disease is being prevented or completely controlled. And that's a whole new era in CF that we're just entering into now. Dr. Jane's group of adult patients is a completely different kettle of fish, and this applies to older kids and teenagers also. They've got established disease, and we know that a lot of these cycles are not shut down completely by the modulators. That's very clear. Even the best case scenario was like a 50% effect on exacerbation rate. So in those particular larger groups of existing patients, we have not come to any understanding of how to withdraw therapy, and that's he addressed that. That's a very difficult area, and hopefully studies can be designed to very carefully withdraw and provide some guidance as to how to do that.
Go ahead, next.
This is a question that's coming in from an online participant, Amy, and it is for Dr. D'Amico. I found your talk on Friday to be so informative and inspiring. I'm particularly impressed with transparency about medical health, particularly understanding your CF journey and your motivations maybe behind your drive to achieve. For those CF people in our community who are maybe scared for or resistant to addressing mental health issues such as therapy, what advice or encouragement would you give? Therapy can be seen as just another thing to add to the list of to-dos. Thank you and congrats.
So happy. Therapy for me, I actually don't view it as a treatment because it actually helps me. So one thing that I think that has helped me a lot in maturing with CF is I looked at my treatments as something that made me not normal. But as I've gotten older, I realized, well, I do my treatment so that I can feel normal. You know, if I don't do my airway clearance, if I don't do my treatments, then I can tell that I have CF. But if I do them, I do feel better. But therapy for me, it's not always just about CF. You know, we're all people. So all the challenges that people face in the room, we have those on top of CF, you know, so stresses with family, with friendships or school, whatever. So it's not like I seek out therapy just for CF, but when I do look for a therapist, and I've shopped around a good bit, I look for people who have experience maybe with medical, or one therapist says that was actually particularly helpful was someone who dealt with people who were in prison before. And it was interesting. We had a conversation about, like, so what happened if CF were cured and you never had to do any of this again? What would it be like? And we actually went down this discussion about how it's kind of like if people are suddenly released from jail. You know, what do you do when you're finally out in the real world? So you can get all these different ways of interpreting CF and interpreting life. So for me, it's an enjoying thing. You know, therapy and treatments aren't really fun, but going to therapy is something that gives me a fresh look on CF. It helps me kind of get through the world in a better sense. And fortunately, I've always gone to a therapist through my university, so they've also been free. Don't know how this is going to work in the real world, but it's something that's been helpful. Also, having friends as well that kind of can double as therapists is kind of nice.
I just want to add to that real quick, from a therapist perspective, for those of you with CF and everyone in this room, finding a good therapist is like finding a really comfortable pair of shoes. Because sometimes you're in the store and you're like, oh my God, these are so cute, they're so this, and then you wear them and you're like, oh my God, these are terrible. What was I thinking? It looked good in the store. And so try on your therapist. It's okay to like go to one therapist and be like, I don't know if I like this one, and go to somebody else and try them out, because you're telling them your deepest, darkest secrets and you want it to be somebody you're comfortable being honest with, right? That's the person you're supposed to talk to. So shop around for a good therapist, and if it's not a good fit, then say thank you very much and go try somebody else, because that's our profession and we're not going to be offended if it's not a good fit. So that's something to keep in mind. And just a plug for CFRI, they offer 8 sessions of free therapy. So 8 sessions is very standard. So take advantage of that, because then you can get therapy. And I know they work with a bunch of different therapists. So just want to throw that plug out there also.
Great. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Barbara Curry, and I'm on the conference committee. And this is sort of a plug for CFRI as well. When we were talking about the attendees at the conference learning certain things and taking it back to their care centers, and maybe the care centers don't know about that, their CFRI has tapes or whatever they're called these days that after the conference, you can contact CFRI and they will give you tapes. What are they? Tapes? What? CDs, all online. And that, so that your care centers can directly go to the online conference and learn about what you've learned about.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thing I love about this panel is that I'm always hungry to know what's happening in other centers, because unless you're moving around the country, it's kind of a lifelong relationship with your center. So my daughter, 5 months on, has been Stanford. So what's been interesting for me and really triggered by the presentation on pain is the role of physical therapy. Nobody's behind me, so I can say, also about mental health issues. It seems each center has a really different model. And of course, we all know CF is so complex, we need many specialty lines to meet the full needs of each individual. But at our center, we don't have a physical therapist embedded on the CF team. Whereas I know, for example, the two doctors that participate in our program teaching at Johns Hopkins and USC, they are a part of the team, and there are these really key issues, you know, stress urinary incontinence, posture issues that help with breathing, pain, that to me it seems like that is such an integral part. So that was a long-winded entry to ask each of you. I'd love to know what happens at your center and what, you know, ancillary support you have for physical therapy, but also I'm curious about mental health.
Well, I'll go ahead and start. I mean, we've been very fortunate that we were able to get a grant to bring from the foundation to bring a physical therapist into our outpatient program. Now, we'd always had a very close relationship with our physical therapy department when patients were admitted. So we had a regular exercise or activity with all our inpatients. One of the things that I really wanted to implement when we started was I don't want patients to sit in bed while they're getting their tune-up. So they go and do something every other day at the minimum and more often. But then the grant allowed us to bring a physical therapist to the outpatient arena. And so we have a physical therapist at every clinic, which has been incredibly valuable. The insights that they provide, the motivation, not just for, you know, activity, but like you said, for pain and how to relax and you know, help with, you know, if patients have arthritis symptoms or chest pain or stress incontinence, they have strategies to help these patients, which is not necessarily you just want to take a pill for everything that, you know, is comes up. So for me, it's been an incredibly valuable experience, and I value our physical therapist tremendously.
So it's Stanford, we don't have a physical therapist embedded, as you mentioned, and I think between the pediatric and adult centers, we've tried to address some of these issues by going outside the group and getting people like Taylor Lewis involved in exercise programs. Julie has been involved with that also, Julie Dash. But for many centers, it's a question of financing, and your team, as your team grows, so does the budget, obviously, and different institutions have different answers for that. We've really grown tremendously in the psychosocial area beyond the social worker who was always part of the both programs to now have psychologists, psychiatrists embedded in the program. And I think you'll find a wide variety of different places that reflect the different financial situations that those centers are in. And in some places, you know, the adult center may just be a single adult physician and a nurse perhaps, and then getting the other people on board is difficult. So it's a hodgepodge of different approaches at different places. And certainly those that have all the ancillary disciplines, I think, are giving the best care and hopefully getting better outcomes. It's an evolving process.
I would echo that money is the hardest part of getting every discipline that you want represented on your CF care team. So our care team has, I think every care team should have a social worker, and we've got a wonderful one who's been working on mental health, and then over the past 3 years we've been lucky enough to have a CFF grant for mental health, and we've had a psychologist on our team who has then been able to provide free therapy to children and young adults with CF, and that has been an amazing gift. And when her grant runs out in 6 to 9 months, she will continue, of course, to provide therapy, but getting funding for that will be much more difficult. And we also have a psychiatrist consultant partner, and those are through, you know, usual insurance measures. And so it's a little bit more challenging because many people have insurance that isn't covered by our psychiatry care. And from a physical therapy perspective, that's something we've really struggled with. We have a respiratory therapist on our team who does pulmonary rehab, so she knows some of the things, but and she has a partnership with a physical therapist that she consults with, but we haven't been able to have the funding to have a physical therapist on our team regularly. So we have we have people available on a consulting basis, but it's not as wonderful as having them in clinic every day, which is balanced by the clinic space. I don't know what everybody else's space is like, but our space is kind of limited, and then time for visits, because some patients like to come in and out and get on with their work day, and the more disciplines that you get to see, the longer your visit is are you willing to give up an hour, 2 hours of your day? So there's just so many competing interests.
I definitely agree and can echo that funding is always an issue to find that out. So I'm from a smaller pediatric center in Pennsylvania, and so for us, PT is inpatient. So we have a great physical therapist inpatient, and so when any of our patients are in, they put the consult in, and PT will come and do treatments for tune-ups or when they're sick. We don't have physical therapy in outpatient, but for we also got a CFF grant for mental health coordinator, and so on our center we have a social worker, and then we have a therapist who is there for counseling, so we do have that. We don't have a psychiatrist on staff either at our center, but if somebody is admitted inpatient, we can put in a consult to psychiatry to do a psych eval for inpatient. But You know, so some of our services that we have are only able to be utilized on an inpatient basis and not outpatient. And then it also comes down to funding and insurance, and there's a lot of other variables that go along with it. There are new mental health guidelines that came out through the foundation, and so part of that is the big push for annual anxiety and depression screens within the clinic, and different centers across the United States are doing them a little bit differently depending on, is the social worker doing the, you know, the assessment for depression anxiety, is the psychologist doing it, is the licensed clinical social worker doing it, so each team is doing something different. But again, it's kind of a shameless plug because I go to NACFC every year and present. But last year and this year, there's a big push because mental health guidelines have now been implemented that now we're seeing the effects of what's happening with this multidisciplinary team. And some centers have physical therapy, occupational therapy, child life, social work, psychology, and psychiatrists. Those are rock star centers and, you know, are very fortunate to have all those resources that some smaller centers don't. So there are centers out there that are very comprehensive, but again, it comes down to funding. Which centers have all that? I don't know off the top of my hand, but there are a couple of them out there. I could think about it. I probably have it. Contact me. I probably have it written down somewhere at home, but there are some centers that do have all these resources in one location, but they are few and far between, but we do have some of those.
Yeah, I was actually just about to say, so I've been to five CF clinics at this point, and none have been that rock star clinic. Maybe Hopkins will be. But a few different thoughts here, and I'm not really sure how they connect, but one, I feel like if I go to a CF clinic visit and my FEV1 is stable or up, BMI is fine, then unfortunately a lot of these other things such as mental health or physical therapy, they're secondary. And unless I'm the plug for it, they don't even come up. The other thought is oftentimes if I have an issue, I sometimes go through my primary care physician to have them be my voice. Because the CF clinic visits are always rushed, they're always so crowded. I mean, that's just the way it is. And unfortunately, you sometimes need to have someone else to be your voice just to have that communication offline.
If I might say something, not as a from a medical, but from a father perspective, our son, we encouraged him. He got into gymnastics and working his upper body and all the things you do with the bars and the tumbling and everything really helped. And I know we have a lot of folks at CFRI whose children get involved with swimming. And swimming, of course, is very good for the lungs. So in terms of you have to be your own advocate, sometimes it's getting your kids involved with sports that will help them in their progress with the disease.
Can I just add something that I think is really important? Reed mentioned that he has a primary care provider that he goes to see for other issues that are unrelated to his CF. And we have many patients who prefer to try to use their CF provider as their primary care provider because they go there four times a year. They're there anyway. Can I just get everything addressed? And it's easy to want to do that, but I would say that as a CF provider, I am not quite as up to date on all the primary care issues that are, especially for, you know, we try to do age-related, age-appropriate screenings and all that, but we are not good primary care providers, so it's important to have a primary care provider in addition.
Yeah, I can't echo that enough. Just, I started using a primary care provider more recently, and I remember talking to her, and she was like, oh, have you ever had your lipids tested? I'm like, no. Usually you just only get things tested that are primarily what you care about in a CF clinic, so it's been incredibly helpful just to keep other things under monitor, just because we with CF are getting older, we don't really know what's going to come up. You know, we're kind of an experiment in and of ourselves. As we get older, what else is going to come? We're on all these different medications now, we're kind of guinea pigs, so having someone else, even another eye, keeping track of what's going on is going to be very helpful.
We have 4 or 5 minutes left, so maybe just one or two last questions. Go ahead.
Recently, I talked to a physician who has had great success healing asthma in patients. And talking to him, he's taking an alternative approach and is not directed to the lungs, it's directed to the gut. So figuring out what bacteria is deficient in the gut and restoring that seems to be healing people with many, many, many years of chronic asthma. And I wonder, since we are learning so much about the microbiome, if in each of your clinics, research in this direction is taking place, because people with CF has so many antibiotics that destroy so much of the flora. So if we are figuring out what is being destroyed and how can we restore that and how do we help these patients to maintain the immune system strong?
Well, there are some studies of probiotics in CF. The ones I'm aware of have been done mainly in Italy. So this is, again, an earlier stage of research, and we don't really have generalized findings or recommendations. But people that are on top of this, we're lucky to have John Mark, who many of you know and saw last night when he got that award, who we rely on to help patients with nutritional changes like probiotics that physicians are often not well trained on. And so we're hoping that that's something that will help some patients. But I don't think we're at the stage where we have generalized recommendations about probiotics to manage things like asthma or infections in CF.
No, I would echo what Richard just said. I mean, I think that the relationship between the gut and the lung is an important one to explore, and we know that the microbiome of the GI tract is not normal in CF patients relative to patients who don't have CF, but how to modulate that and how clearly antibiotics help. You know, one of the reasons patients are doing better is because antibiotics are available now, but how to use them most efficiently, most effectively, and how to pair them with something like a probiotic, I don't think we actually know at this point how to do that.
Okay, last question.
This might be very quick. Regarding differences in the way that, now I'm forgetting nouns, the different CF centers operate. A few months ago, a family from a different center brought the notion up that they're not instructed to do the vest right after Pulmozyme to allow Pulmozyme to work before trying to force it out of the lungs. Is there any data that supports waiting 10 minutes, 30 minutes before doing the vest to let it work? Or are we pretty much feeling like it, you know, right after Pulmozyme is done, the vest should be done?
I mean, I think that as far as I know, there's no studies that have looked at timing of airway clearance relative to your nebulization treatments. There's a little bit of information about sequence, but not much about, you know, how long to wait or whatever. And some of it just becomes, from my perspective, a practical consideration. If you have, you know, sometimes people will put multiple medications into, which I don't recommend, that's from a time perspective. There's not, it's kind of an understudied area. For as much as we do and recommend, we don't really have a good handle on, you know, whether you need 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, twice a day is clearly better than once a day. So that kind of data just doesn't really exist, and we sort of use more of a common sense approach, I would say.